Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPO 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
And joining us is Burl Bear. And how are you doing today?
Oh, just dandy. I'm doing better than my dog. I took the dog to the vet, and she's depressed.
Why? She doesn't have to pay the vet bill.
Oh, no, I'm the one who's depressed about that. We don't want to insult her. We call her a Staffordshire Terrier. Her name is Isis, which, of course, is just every time the news comes on, she hides.
Yeah. Not a popular name right now.
No, it's not. Isis is evil, Isis is that. When I was a kid, my friend Larry Siegel had a dog whose name was actually Spot. And we were over there having dinner one night, Sunday night, and the Hallmark Hall of Fame was on. And they had Macbeth. And when Lady Macbeth said, "Oh, damn Spot," the dog got up and left the room.
You've just been a god in the writing world.
Oh, yes. Like I just,
yeah.
Well, I've done a lot of writing because I'm not very athletic, and that's, have an excuse why I'm not exercising. I have to write.
I read two of your books. And
really? Which two did you
The mini book about the Tacoma murder.
Robert Henry.
Yeah, that's it. And that was the first kind of encounter I had with you. And then after
that's
I...
Tragic story, that one.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That was, they all are.
All the reasons, I mean, the people aren't familiar with the story. It was, I wanted to do a book on that one for a long time, and Detective Robert Yerbury was the detective on point on that one. I mean, here you have a guy, everything's going his way. He's got a great wife, he's got a great job, everything's wonderful. He's done with work for the day, comes out to the parking lot, and out of the bushes comes a guy dressed all in black with a shotgun and a black helmet on, and basically executes this guy right in the parking lot of the office building. Shoots him with a shotgun and takes off on a motorcycle and basically leaves no clues. And you can't figure out who would want to killed this nice guy. He didn't have any drug debts, he had gambling debts, he wasn't involved in anything shady. And, his wife just is, of course, is devastated. And, it was someone he knew, someone who was formerly a good buddy of his. They got into an argument at Christmas, and it was, over what was a better hobby, boats or planes. That's why I killed him.
Yeah, I remember that. I thought that was kind of weird.
I'd say so.
Well, I just, you know what I mean. I just didn't think it was enough to be that angry.
Yeah. The widow and I had a conversation about that because there's an excellent episode of a TV series called Motives and Murders, Cracking the Case on Investigation Discovery. And they did a fantastic, I thought, adaptation for their show. They interviewed both a lot of people. They interviewed the detective, and they interviewed Henry Widow, and they interviewed me. And she and I talked about that. I said, if you don't mind me saying so, all the reasons on earth, if there's a valid reason ever to go shoot somebody, the fact that they have a different hobby than you, and you got into an argument about that.
You know, it still struck me as it's just, if for me, it couldn't be enough. I couldn't imagine being that upset over what's a better hobby to do, sail or fly, and then to actually go to such trouble.
The guy is obviously, I think the technical term is Bissell Bashunga. The guy's, he's a little nuts.
Yeah.
But that's not an adequate defense for a premeditated murder. He had an alibi, and it took him, so that was the longest investigation in Tacoma police history. It took them a long time because they finally found a murder weapon, but it was years later. Found it in the bushes, so found it in the bushes. And it's kind of like that movie with Brad Pitt and 8,000 other people that won the Academy Award a few years ago. Babel, or something like that. Where this gun makes it all the way around the world. This is the kind of the same thing. They had to trace, all the different people who owned that shotgun. And it wasn't easy to do. And turns out it was that guy. And he was harassing the widow for years because they worked in the same company. And he would sit at lunch next to her, like, make faces and,
Yeah, I remember that. That's just nuts.
Yeah. Normal people, first of all, don't kill people. Second of all, if they were semi-normal and they killed people, they wouldn't do it in a fight over what was a better hobby. Collecting stamps or parcheesi. Then he has the nerve to sue from prison.
Oh, that's right. That's right, yeah.
Fortunately, they threw that thing out. But, he's a real piece of work, that guy. Yeah, that little booklet is called a mini true crime book. Yeah. It's called Murder on 9/11. That's what happened. It didn't happen the same 9/11 as, 9/11, that New York thing with the terrorists or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was on that date that Robert Edwards was murdered. And it was on that same date, was it 9 years later or something, that the guy was sent off to prison.
And he's in there for life now, isn't he?
Yeah, that's usually what they do. Although sometimes they get less than that, or sometimes they get more. But I think he's in there for life. It was first degree premeditated murder, he planned ahead of time. And that was a story I'd wanted to tell for some time. Another story that I'd wanted to tell for a long time that I finally got the opportunity was a story called the Alaska Mail Bomb Conspiracy. And that's in a great book, called Masters of True Crime, and it's a compendium of stories by various brilliant and talented true crime writers, such as myself, of course. Another one of those stories that you go, what were these people thinking? A guy gets a package in the mail addressed to his son, and he figures, I'll open it in case it's something important, and it blew up. We found his knuckles on the roof. Melted his wife's face. It was just, who would do it? Why would they do it? And the only people who had a motive were already in prison for murder because he testified against them. And sure enough, that's who did it. They had their the one guy's sister build the bomb, and she was, just about ready to go into labor. She takes her daughter to the post office to mail this bomb to this guy. Wow. Could have blown herself up too, which might have been a nice move.
Yeah.
But always wanted, that's a real strange story. I always wanted to tell that one. That's one of the few cases, I think maybe the only one in American history, where someone is found guilty and sentenced for a crime they were never charged with.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of people wonder about that. Eric Moriarty, who I have a crush on and who I often tease, she was on my radio show a couple of years ago, and I mean, she said, that's impossible. You can't convict someone of something they haven't been charged with, because you don't have to be able to defend yourself. But, oh, no, American trial. They really wanted to convict the guy of something. They asked him if he wanted to convict him of it, they just on general principle said, we're going to find him guilty of something.
Yeah.
So, anyway, they found him guilty of something he was never charged with.
Wow. Well, there you go.
Well, things are so strange. I mean, we don't have American justice. We have American courts, American laws. But I think Americans are very naive about how things work. But one reason prosecutors get so many convictions is that people plea bargain to make deals, because even if they're not guilty, because they're so concerned that if they do go to court, because they're warned, like, listen, if you don't plead out, if you plead not guilty and go to court, it'll be worse for you. You know, because they'll find you guilty. If they find you guilty, you'll get twice as long as a sentence, you'll get this, you'll get that. So why don't you just plead it out? So there's lots of people in there who took a plea deal that, you know, worked or didn't do it. If you're the person who did do it, go out there somewhere. Because it's just so prevalent.
Yeah.
Particularly back in New York under Giuliani, I was saying that one reason he had so many, such a high, rate of convictions or whatever is because he'd make people stay in jail until their trials, and then would stretch it out a long period of time, and so people would plead out just to get out of jail.
And so now your big book.
My big in size or
yeah.
Yes. Got about 13 books out there, so
yeah. No, the big one.
My biggest book in terms of size may be either Love at the Cost of Life, which is a true story, oral history of the persecution of the Baha'i religious minority in Iran at the time of the revolution that came out this year, or it could be The Saint, A Complete History in Print, Radio, Television, Film, that came out before you were born, but continues to sell.
I remember The Saint, the original.
Yes, the famous Simon Templar, the devil with dames, the headache of cops and crooks alike.
I remember.
I'm lying here, I'm not laying there, being egg. I'm lying here on the futon, reclining supine on my spine, looking up at 1, 2, 3, 4 Saint one sheets from the movies. Have The Saint of New York, the man who did something.
Yeah.
One Man War on Crime. No, yeah, The Saint takes over with George Saunders. Saint's Girl Friday, Lily Hayward, and Saint Meets the Tiger, starring Hugh Sinclair, who had large ears and a beautiful voice. I wrote about the movies, the radio shows, the TV shows. I was able to meet him 2 weeks to the day before he passed away. Bought me lunch at a little coffee shop in Surrey, and that was a real delight.
What made you write The Saint? Like, what made you do that? Like, that was...
Well, that I could answer very easily. It was, when I say so in the introduction, I say, this is the book I always wanted to read. I kept going to the library. Remember those? I kept going to the library. I think it was kind of like bookstores. People haven't seen them in a long time. Although we do have a new library here in Stevenson Ranch. But I go to the library hoping someone had written a comprehensive history of The Saint from the very first book of the 1920s up to the whatever was going on right now. And I kept looking and looking, and finally, I thought I was going to write a magazine article for, I think, Video Review or Video 1 and 2. On the same movies that were available on VHS at that time. Well, my crafty, very clever little nephew, Lee Goldberg, who has had several New York Times bestsellers with Janet Ivanovich, he had a series with her that's doing incredibly well. He without me knowing, wrote a proposal for a complete same book and sent it to McFarland Publishers. And I think it was the first Saturday after the 4th of July in 1990, I think. I showed up in Moonlight, Washington to go finish with my dad, and he said, hey, you got a letter. Yeah, you go out the house, home address. And there was a contract for a book. Due in a year, I got to stretch it out a bit, so thank you, Lee. And that's the book I won the Edgar for, my first book. And the nice thing about winning an Edgar is they can't take it away from you.
Yeah. No matter what you do.
No matter what you do. It's kind of like Aldo Ray won the Academy Award. At the end of his career, he was doing porno movies.
Yeah.
You know, as the doctor said, don't try this at home. You know, whatever I write, they just they put it on the front, Edgar Award winner. And it's true, I did win one. I got it to look like a little bust of Hitler. Said, well, oh, but it looks like a, you know, it looks like Hitler. You can't tell the difference. People say, why do you have a plaster cast of Hitler on your mantle?
Yeah.
I know. Not Hitler, it's Edgar Allan Poe.
Well, and your Man Overboard.
Man Overboard, the counterfeit resurrection of Phil Champagne. Now, I drove people crazy. When that book first came out 20 years ago, I became known as the King of BSP, which means blatant self-promotion. I sold that book like it was a Vegematic salesman at a county fair. And people weren't always happy with that technique, but I did sell a lot of books. Now, 20 years later, Man Overboard, the Counterfeit Resurrection of Phil Champagne, is back with a new introduction, a couple new paragraphs, new ending, new pictures. It is a true story, I guess, unless it's a pack of lies. And if it is a pack of lies, at least the lies are well packaged. Here's the basic premise of the book. You ready, Alan?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right, brace yourself.
I am.
1982. Was it 1982? I think so. Oregon businessman Phil Champagne dies in a tragic boating accident off Lopez Island, Washington. He is survived by one ex-wife, four adult children, an octogenarian mother, and two despondent brothers. Phil didn't know he was dead until he read it in the newspaper. All things considered, he took it rather well. 10 years later, 1992, Washington State restaurateur Harold Stegman, famous for his thick, juicy steaks, is arrested by the United States Secret Service for putting counterfeit $100 bills in a tiny shed in Idaho. In addition to the bogus bills, Stegman also has a fraudulently obtained United States passport, a fabricated Cayman Islands driver's license, and Phil Champagne's fingerprints. Yes, it's a story of fraud, deception, trickery, lies, and fine prime rib. And probably one of the few true crime books that's actually amusing, vastly amusing, hysterically funny. At least that's what they said when they read it. Maybe I didn't intend it to be that funny, but they said it was funny. So.
Well, it did kind of come out that way, you know, when I was reading. I mean, did you ever get to meet him personally?
Oh, yes. Phil's 84 years old. I talked to him just the other day. And what a charming gentleman. Oh, yeah. When I first met Phil, I think Anna Rule was going to do it originally, because she knows the family. Her daughter and Phil's daughter are good friends. But she was tied up on other projects. Somehow I got recommended and suggested. We got a phone call from Buck Ormsby, you know, famous bass player up there in Seattle.
Yeah.
And he faxed me all the information. And Phil at that time was in the federal prison in Spokane, by Spokane, Washington. Well, I was living in Walla Walla, which is, 147 miles. So I jumped in my Volvo 1800 same mobile and drove up there. And Phil had already had some other offers approach him about a book, because this had made the news, and all the talk shows wanted him, Montel Williams, and, you know.
Yeah.
I went to do somebody's father. I don't know. Anyway, so I went in there, and I didn't go in and say, hi, I'm Burl Bear, and I want to write a book about you being such a decommitted criminal. Instead, I went in, and I got a cup of coffee and a styrofoam cup, sat down, sat down opposite him and said, how good were the bills, Phil? And he started bragging about how good the bills were, that the bills made it all the way to Federal Reserve Bank in Seattle before they were detected. Well, we just kind of got off in a big conversation about counterfeiting and why did he swap the money out differently than he did. And so you knew we were doing a book.
Yeah, and he's been at your book signing, hasn't he, or something?
Oh, that's one of GM Ford's history writer. Great guy. He just cracked him up. Is I took to some signings, so you could get the true crime book, not only signed by the true crime author, but by the true criminal. And by the criminal's wife. So I happen to know that the Clintons, former President Clinton and former First Lady Hillary Clinton, have a copy of Man Overboard in their ex-presidential library, I guess you call it.
Yeah.
Signed by Burl and by Phil and by Barb Fraley, who's Phil's wife, who didn't know who she was marrying. Didn't know if she was marrying Harold or Phil or what it was.
Yeah, that's quite a story. So for the people that don't know, let's run through the story. How did it all start?
Well, you know, here was Phil. He was, 57 years old. You know, he's working in a construction business. His brother, you know, he had a company. And, of course, his key man insurance on Phil in case something should happen. But everything is just pretty much going to hell in a cosmic handbasket. There's problems on the construction site. If you remember in the 80s, if you were around then, the interest rates on loans for building a home were just, you know, through the roof. No one could afford it.
Yeah.
He was going through a bad divorce. And to cheer him up, his brothers took him out on a little, you know, treat. Let's go sailing. Let's go up to the Great Pacific going west where we already are, but let's go farther up and go drinking and fishing and, you know, we'll get some sunshine. And well, fine, except Phil got a little bit drunk, didn't have his deck shoes on, and they're out there in the, off Lopez Island, and Phil falls overboard. And the Coast Guard searched for his body for 13 hours, didn't find him. That's because he was rescued by an illegal fisherman who couldn't exactly take him to the hospital and say where they found him.
Right.
All Phil had was hypothermia. The guy lets him stay there a couple of days, so he's go back on his feet, drops him off at Anacortes. Well, that's when Phil reads in the paper that he's dead.
Yeah.
He goes, it's a heck of a deal. You know. I didn't just stop and think. He goes, yeah. I'm thinking, well, I could go to hell, though. Honey, I'm not dead. You can keep suing me for divorce.
Yeah.
But everyone thinks he's dead. Now, nowadays, you couldn't get away with what Phil did, but back then you could. You could make fake driver's license, fake IDs with a letter set kit. You could, you know, no one in Washington with a Rhode Island driver's license look like. You could make it up, you know. They have holograms on it or anything like that. You don't just make yourself a new ID, new driver's license. Who knew?
Yeah.
So he reinvents himself. Excuse me. And goes to Mexico, gets involved in all sorts of amazing adventures, goes to Florida. He's whining and dying. He's got women by the handful, got a sack by quarter with the corner of the room, because he was a good-looking guy, and he was useful to have around the house. Well, he winds up getting involved in all sorts of, not that he's a criminal, but I don't want to give away the whole plot, but he winds up with drug smugglers and criminals out to kill him, and he finally gets the best on them. Alice by 7 goes back to Washington with a new name and a whole bunch of money. However, slight error on Phil's part. The name he chose, Harold Richard Stegman. He got the name off a graveyard in Florida of someone who was born but didn't live to adulthood who died as a child.
Right.
And what he didn't know is that organized crime had used that same graveyard a long time ago. And that name, Harold Richard Stegman, is well known around the world, like Kaiser Soze. So many people have used the name. Senate minority leader of New Jersey, whose name escapes me at the moment, used that same name on his passport when he faked his death in the Bahamas and then flew to the Maldives Islands The feds actually arrested Phil, who was Harold Zeidman. Yeah, thinking they had an international criminal, they had photographs that showed him a guy on it. I couldn't see his face, but a guy leading a revolution in Africa on a tank. That's Harold Zeidman. Smuggling guns, Harold Zeidman. Human trafficking, Harold Zeidman. Diamond smuggling, Harold Zeidman. They think that they have got the biggest criminal in the history of the universe. His fingerprints didn't match anything. He didn't, you know, he had no criminal record. But the name, Harold Zeidman, boy, did they get a print out on that name. So he was able to cut a deal. Gentlemen, I'll tell you everything about my man's criminal empire. If you give me the lowest possible sentence, I'm a counterfeiting. So they cut a deal. They tell him everything about his vast criminal empire. In return, he gets a work release, 18 months, for having a phony passport, conspiracy to counterfeit. And the first question they asked him was, what kind of copy camera did you use to take the picture of the 1990 Series E $100 bill that you counterfeited? He just said, gentlemen, if I could have afforded a copy camera, I wouldn't have needed to become a counterfeiter. I built a box camera, which he said, out of a piece of cardboard, kind of a cardboard box with a pinhole poked in it, a lens from a broken camera from St. Vincent de Paul. He didn't have frosted glass, which you need, you know, for a box camera. So he found a broken window pane and he put Scotch matching tape on it. It worked just fine, thank you. And then he hand-colored all the bills with one of those little hobby paint sets. A little low-tech. But they got the deal, they had the honor.
Well, days were simpler back then.
You know, from all the true crime books I've written a lot, the only one nominated for an award was nominated for an Anthony Award for Best True Crime at the World History Convention. Anna Rule's Dead by Sunset was nominated that same year. She says, oh, girl, I know you're going to win. I said, no, Anne, you're going to win. I was right. She won. But what's interesting is that she shows up in my book, Man Overboard, because her family and Phil's family were friends. And my family shows up in her book, Dead by Sunset, because the victim worked for my brother's law firm. And in fact, the killer, the photographer, he took photographs of my brother and my wife and kids that are hanging on the wall of his home. So, true crime is a small world.
Yeah, certainly is. And that, do you think that, like Phil Champagne, or whatever his name, Harold.
Yeah, Phil Champagne, that's his real name, yeah.
And his brother got,
$600,000, yeah.
Right. So now they seem to keep going after him and thinking that
Well, yeah. In fact, they went after me. When the book came out, Federal Kemper Life Insurance Company was, being that Phil was alive, they paid out, originally the policy was $1.5 million. They paid Phil's brother a half of that because the body wasn't recovered at the circumstances of Phil's death. Well, when Phil showed up alive in counterfeiting under a different name years later, Federal Kempers went after Mitch, the Champagne, Phil's brother, saying they wanted his $600,000 back. Well, they thought maybe some money was coming to Phil from the book. You know, maybe he had a contract with the publisher. So they tried to put like a garnishment or a freeze or something on money from my publisher at that time to Phil. Of course, the publisher wouldn't know Phil Champagne if he passed the counterfeit bill. They just had a contract with me. Long story short, for some legal reason, which is probably too complicated to go into, they dropped the whole thing and let it go. So,
yeah.
Federal Kempers at all,
yeah,
the money.
Yeah.
So that's...
Do they think that the brother was in on it?
Well, they thought maybe it was that Phil faked his death, that it was a plot between the brothers. If so, it was a fairly clever one. Phil's soon-to-be ex-wife, who's going through divorce with, sued the other brother for Phil's wrongful death. He collected $150,000. it's kind of like everyone benefited from this somewhat. So if it was a scam, it was well done.
Yeah.
Phil, of course, said, no, I didn't fake my death. I simply didn't contradict it.
Yeah.
When Phil showed up, when they finally figured out who he was, he never did tell them. FBI could not figure out who he was. Interpol couldn't figure it out. CIA, none of them could figure it out. Because he had no criminal record, so his fingerprints didn't match anything. Lyle Workman, who was the Secret Service agent on this case, who really liked Phil, by the way, just on the most bizarre hunch, walks into the Spokane, Washington Police Department with the fingerprints and says, "Will you run these, please?" And they got a match. And the only reason for that was due to an error. When Phil was 19 years old, after he was 63 at the time of his arrest, when he was 19 years old, he got in trouble for taking a car without permission. And that should have been expunged from his record, decades and decades ago. But for some reason, it was still in the Spokane, Washington system. They said, "Oh, these are the fingerprints of Philip Wendell Champagne." "Well, what's his criminal record?" "He doesn't have one."
Mm-hmm.
When he was 19, we fingerprinted him.
Yeah. Wow.
That's
quite a life.
Yeah, what a life. Now he's 84, he's got all these grandkids, and still good looking, still handsome and charming.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Yeah.
Do it
while you can,
Yeah. It was funny, there was a lot of interest in making it into a movie. I wish somebody would, or a TV movie. And I was meeting this one director, producer guy. He says, "Would Phil mind if we made some changes in the story, perhaps make his wife's brother a detective who's working on the case, typical area?"
Yeah.
I said, "But the truth is," if I may quote Phil, "I don't give a damn if they make me a cartoon mouse as long as they write me a check."
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I like that.
I guess Dr. Gerald said, if you sell a story or a book to Hollywood, you go to the California border, and you toss a manuscript over the border, lands there, they pick it up, they throw you a suitcase of money. And you take the suitcase, you put it in the trunk of your car, you drive away, and you don't look back. You can't be married to it, because, I mean, how did you see Burglar based on the Lawrence Block's great series about the guy who runs the older guy, the 50s, retired burglar. But he wanted to be a burglar again, even though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Whoopi Goldberg played in the movie.
Yeah.
That wasn't exactly what I had in mind. It wasn't like Eddie Murphy wanted to play the same. I guess it could be.
Yeah.
But they change everything. Sometimes it works out. Gone But Not Forgotten, an incredible book, was made with TV movie with Lou Diamond Phillips. And the people who are male in the book are female in the TV movie and vice versa. But sometimes that works there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Now, also, you have to mention that in Man Overboard, you've got a brand new afterwards in there by Phil as well, right?
Yeah. Phil wrote the afterwards, and I wrote a new introduction explaining some things. You know, when the book first came out, there was a big front-page article in the Coeur d'Alene, Idaho newspaper with a big picture of Phil and who he really was and, you know, about the book and then some lady saw Phil on the street, and she just lit into him. You are a horrible person. You're this, you're that. She's just reading him the riot act. He stands there and listens to it all at once. She's all finally runs out of steam. He just looks at her and says, I bet your husband wishes he could fall off the sailboat. Which is probably quite true.
That's just that's an amazing story, actually. Quite.
Well, it's available in a brand new 20th anniversary special edition. The bonus features, just like the Criterion DVD.
Yeah. and call now.
Wild Blue Press. Yeah, wildbluepress.com. You can get it direct from them. You can get it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Barnes & Noble, Libris, Books A Million. Walk into a bookstore and demand it.
Demand. Don't leave.
I demand this book by Burl Bear, Man Overboard, The Counterfeit Resurrection of Phil Champagne. It's got a cool cover.
The subject tonight, true crime. Guest, Burl Bear. We'll be back right after these words. I was talking to Lee Mahler and then...
Serial Killer Quarterly. Every serial killer's favorite quarterly magazine.
Exactly.
It is... You know, it sounds when you hear the name Serial Killer Quarterly, you think, oh, come on. But when you see the thing, it is one absolutely gorgeous, professional, top-of-the-line magazine with, maybe my article exceptions, but everybody else's articles are really, really good and scholarly and well-illustrated. I mean, it is one heck of a good, I'd say better than good, excellent magazine by any standard.
Yeah.
So if you're interested in serial killers or that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I've been going through it. There's some great stories. He's a great editor, actually. He does a really good job.
He's fabulous.
Yeah.
And he's really, I almost said he's really into necrophilia. But he studies it. Not that he watches it informed necessarily, but yeah. He's researching that.
Well, I'm leaving that one alone.
Woody Allen's former wife,
was
raped, I think, in New York at one time. He got in trouble because he went to the reporters and said, what is comment about your ex-wife being violated? He said, knowing her was a moving violation.
Okay.
I don't write the jokes, folks. I just tell them.
Yeah. Don't take it personal.
Yeah.
Now, on that one. Now, did you did a little story on the Yorkshire Ripper?
Yeah, I did. But the Yorkshire ripoff. Peter Sutcliffe. He's a copycat. He didn't do most of them. I know some people think Nilo Guerra, who wrote the book about the real Yorkshire Ripper, is a little bit over the top. But I'll tell you something. His research is pretty darn good. He has some things theoretically that have already been proven and some that have been disproven. But based on my horrifying number of years as a human being on the planet, once you've been marginalized when you're right, it creates almost a panic desperation. I don't know if you can follow what I'm saying, but if you've ever been marginalized and told that people said, well, you can't believe what he says, he's nuts. But you're actually right about something, and people are like automatically discounting you. It makes you almost start grasping at straws just to get back to your basic point. So he gets a little worked up in some areas where he needn't be, except for the fact that people have picked on him about this. But I do believe he's absolutely correct that the fellow that they're calling the Yorkshire Ripper is a copycat. The cops fed him a lot of the information because some stuff he had did wrong, pardon the pun. And that, yes, he did kill people. Yeah, I think he killed about 4 of the 13. But who killed the rest of them? And that's a different story altogether.
Right.
But so I had a great time writing the article, and I was really blown away when I saw what a great job Lee did as far as editing and illustrating and, you know, framing the story. So that's out in the paperback too. It's kind of like, you know, the Serial Killer Quarterly's Greatest Hits or something.
Yeah. why was there such a big stir about that with Noel Guerra? Like, why? Why did people jump on him so much? I'm sort of surprised.
They do that.
Well, yeah, I know. There's some nasty ones out there, but I just it just sort of surprised me because I thought what he wrote was quite good.
Yeah, so did I. But there are people who, I mean, it's not like people will start taking sides in cases and things like that and get all worked up. I think actually he's quite accurate and correct on the majority of what he says. You know, the one that no one pays any attention to and totally discounts on a different topic, and that is on Jack the Ripper, the book Hand of a Woman. And I don't know how accurate it was, but I thought the book was absolutely fascinating. Jack the Ripper was a woman and who the woman was. And she went to the mental institution, and not that she necessarily got away with it, but, you know.
Yeah.
That's who she was and why she did it. That was a really interesting concept, but it's true or not. And we won't know.
Yeah. I didn't even hear about that one.
Check that book. It's called Hand of a Woman.
Huh, I will. Because, I interviewed Russell Edward last year, you know, naming Jack the Ripper, and... Tom Westcott. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's the other one. I met him like a few times about the handwriting and the blood samples. Was his great grandfather Jack the Ripper?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I got to get them all together in one room. Like I read about the mental institution where the three guys all thought they were Jesus, so they put them all in a room together to see what would happen. The way to get me to wash each other's feet, I guess.
Yeah.
it was an interesting experiment.
I bet. I found that to be an interesting subject, but, so long ago. I don't even know, why are people still, why do they pick certain serial crimes and stick with them? Like Jack the Ripper or Zodiac and things like that.
Oh, because it gives them something to do in their spare time.
Yeah, but what picks them out separately then? Because there's been some real other horrific ones that really get no attention.
Oh, yeah. Well, that one I think is atmospheric because it's like a TV show or a movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
It's kind of like, I find it bizarrely related somehow. People who are, shall we say, beyond the pale of religious fundamentalism to where it becomes almost pathological. They'll be talking, the Bible says this, the Bible says that. And no, it doesn't, but what they're talking about is Dante's Inferno. You know, they're talking about, you know, poems they never read or heard about, you know, or things they've seen in movies. And it's like, that's from The Exorcist. No, that's from Gone with the Wind. where are they coming up with this stuff?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, I know.
And, the people just get hooked in the things in their imagination runs wild, and they just get... I didn't know quite how to break this to Rhonda Glover, who is the murderess in my book, Fatal Beauty. I went to see her in prison, and plexiglass, you know, between us, so she could kill me if she wanted to. I think when the book came out, she wanted to. But yeah. Before that, she was nuts. She used to be in a mental institution. You know, it had been nuts. The only reason they declared her competent to stand trial is they said, just don't mention the caves and the clones. Because the reason she killed her boyfriend is she believed that he and George W. Bush were having homosexual sex with clones in the cave under her house in Austin.
Yeah, and what's the problem?
Well, because George didn't get an invitation.
Oh.
You're not going to start without me again.
Yeah.
So, one of the reasons that she thought she was on this mission from God to kill her boyfriend was because she, of Oaks, she lived on Oak Drive in River Oaks near, you know, Oak Park, you know, everything was Oak, 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 Oak. And she said, you know, in the Bible it says, my oaks are this, but I knew a little bit about the topic, and I said, oh, this is the King James Version, aren't you? And I said, actually, it's tamarind. Tamarind is a very scruffy, ugly-looking bush. Not like George. that is where you get his turpentine. I said, but they don't have tamarinds in England. So when they did, then, you know, the King James Version, they changed it to oak, because people knew what oaks were. I said, but actually, in the original Hebrew, it's a tamarind, not an oak.
Yeah.
That was one big, you know, motivations of her killing the guy.
Yeah. All right.
What?
Yeah. Crazy. So, where do you see yourself going next? Like, what's the big thing next?
boy, I'm working on. It's almost ready to go to Wild Blue to be published. Doing a book with famed journalist Frank Girardo. Doesn't have a title, because if we give it the original title, it's a murder mystery, and you'll know right away. It's a true crime story, but we're not necessarily framing it by telling you this is who did it, you know.
Okay.
I'll tell you, and you won't tell anybody.
No.
it's a horrifying true story of a real nice guy who winds up very, very dead on his bedroom floor, and his wife is upset, his stepdaughter is upset. They do the autopsy on the guy, and they find something very peculiar. There's no reason for him to be dead. He's too healthy to be dead. Guy's in perfect health, except for one thing.
He's dead. Yeah.
And so it's the story of the husband, the wife, the investigation, and finally the capture of the killer who caught themselves. The killer puts themselves into the investigation and solves the crime for the police. It is really a bizarre story, but it's pretty fascinating. And we're just putting the finishing touches on it to send it off to Wild Blue, who agreed to publish it. And then following that, I've got a new Satan novel that's almost done. It was supposed to have been done about 3 years ago, but it's almost done. And then I'm doing a book on a case that you should probably have on your show if you haven't already, the IRP6. Guys from a computer company charged with a non-existent crime and sent 7 to 14 years in prison. and no one could quite figure out what they were arrested for or why. And it's pretty, that's also a pretty fascinating case because Homeland Security is involved and the anti-terrorism people and the FBI. And it's the only real danger from that case is I've had some other people warn me to say, well, if you're doing something, you're exposing some degree of corruption or whatever at high levels of our federal government, like if it was Homeland Security or showing how stupid they are or whatever, it may cause you personal problems, like they did with the guy who wrote Dark Alliance, you know, about how the cocaine that they were selling in Los Angeles was coming from our wife, federal government, to finance the Contras.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had Ricky Ross, he's a great guy, Freeway Ricky, who was selling millions of dollars worth of crack and cocaine, didn't realize it was coming from Oliver North, our great patriotic American.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think of all that? Do you just think that it just goes on, that kind of corruption?
Oh, constantly.
Yeah.
Oh, constantly.
Yeah.
That's one thing that you learn. I was just writing an article with some of you. Well, see, it's actually Derek Kaminoki, who does Deadly Sins TV show.
Right. Yeah.
He's doing a seminar for with a company called AcademicAddictions.com. They do teaching seminars, you get credit for them and everything, the educational stuff. And he's doing one on the history of drug laws in America and alternative sentencing, you know, court diversion where you have drug courts instead of, you know. And every major drug legislation in America has been the result of what's called a moral panic. And that's where you either create a crisis that doesn't exist, or you take something that isn't a crisis and you make it one just long enough to get law passed, and then suddenly it disappears from everyone's consciousness. All the scary stories stop, and you move on to the next. And what they always do is pick a minority that uses that particular drug. For example, the very first one was opium dens. There was all this Chinese prejudice. You know, Chinese are stealing our jobs. They built the railroads, but now we've got to get rid of those slanty-eyed bastards. And so they suddenly there's an opium den epidemic. We've got to close down those opium dens. Well, the only people using opium dens were the Chinese, so it was pretty much targeting them. So basically they had Chinese laws, and then they got the Chinese exclusion law where the Chinese couldn't become citizens and all that stuff. Then, during the Mexican Revolution, we had a lot of Mexican immigrants coming to America to get away from the Revolution. Well, they're stealing our jobs and taking our women. So what drug do they do? Oh, they do marijuana. Okay, we'll make marijuana illegal so we can put a lot of Mexicans in prison. Next thing you know, there's all these fake stories coming out about Negroes on cocaine raping white women. Even though there's been the Pure Food and Drug Act and the importation of coca had gone down by over 50%, but what was the most famous moral panic was the one about crack babies. Remember that one?
Wow.
All these kids born on crack with no souls will have an endless army of mutant teenage turtles or something roaming our streets with guns. And of course, none of that was true. In fact, during that whole drug panic of the 80s, if you look at the actual federal figures, because they do keep track of this stuff, despite what you heard in the news, drug use was actually down in the 80s for the previous decade.
Yeah.
You know, and there wasn't everybody testing as crack babies, but it did get legislation. Legislation would put more and more people in prison, which is a business we got to itself.
Yeah, that's a business itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons for the bringing crack into L.A. was to make sure there was a criminal underclass that could be continually put in prison.
So what do you think is going to happen now with pot kind of going more the legal way?
Well, I've already seen some interesting propaganda. Just came out of what law enforcement body it was. Is because pot is now legal in, you know, several states, or decriminalized in some as well. This has really hurt the drug cartels, which you think that would be good, right?
Yeah.
Oh, no, because they're not making all that money off of the pot. They are flooding the streets. Anytime you see things flooding the streets, that means it's BS.
Yeah.
Flooding the streets with with methamphetamine, and people get all upset. We better make pot illegal again so we won't flood the streets with methamphetamines. First of all, the cartels don't even deal with methamphetamines. You can make that at Walmart.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to be in the Andes, you know, to grow it. I mean, you're going, oh, come on. You know, here's a real clue for you. Anytime you see the word epidemic used and it's not referring to smallpox or typhoid fever or any other real communicable physical disease, that means someone's working a moral panic. Because anytime you take a social issue and use epidemic, it means two things. One, you don't have to deal with the social issue, or whatever the social problem is. And two, someone has to carry that epidemic disease. That makes it them and us. If it's an epidemic of what? Oh, gee, who uses this? They're talking about a heroin epidemic. That must be those heroin addicts. Let's lock them all up. Or shoot them or whatever.
Yeah.
Or if it's blacks in the inner city with crack, oh yeah, so let's make the drug sentence, the prison sentencing for people doing crack 100 times greater than people doing powder and arrest a lot of black people. You know, there's always some legislative motive or groups that want federal funding because they can treat the problem. Right? These people started lobbying for a piece of the money. There was just a study done when I was researching this on methamphetamine laws and who frames them, who framed the problem, and that it's mostly law enforcement. Law enforcement frames the problem, necessarily creates it or invents it or whatever, and then gets legislation passed and then gets funding to fight the problem that probably wasn't there to begin with.
Yeah.
I was reading articles about the meth epidemic when in reality methamphetamine use in America peaked about 20 years ago. Scott Bond, Dr. Scott Bond, has written some excellent books. I don't know if he's been on the show or not. He wrote a book about why we love serial killers. And he writes for Psychology Today. And he teaches a class on deviant behavior. He hasn't brought me in as a specimen yet. He wrote a great book called Mass Deception, Moral Panic, and the Iraq War. And he studied all the build-up to our invasion of Iraq in the structure of moral panic and how it was orchestrated, the words that are used that are like buzzwords that you always use in a moral panic. You identify things as evil, or people as evil, because the only way to deal with evil is kill it. You know, you can't negotiate with it. So you have your axis of evil, you have this evil empire, whatever it is.
How do people get a hold of you if they want to get a hold of you?
I have got a page on Facebook, several pages actually, and I do a radio show called True Crime Uncensored. It's on outlawradiousa.com every Saturday at 2 o'clock. By email, I have two actually. Adora Burl, how do you like that? A-D-O-R-A-B-U-R-L, Adora Burl at gmail.com, or Burl at burlbearer.net. B-A-R-E-R. And also I have a website, burlbearer.net. It's got a charming picture of me. And you can go on Amazon or Barnes & Noble and type in Burl Bearer. You'll see, wow, you can buy all sorts of books.
Just tons. Yeah. It's the gorgeous.
Buy all of them.
Yes.
I have several true crime books from Kensington Publishing, Body Count, Murder in the Family, which is my New York Times bestseller for them.
Headshot.
Ran out of books on that. But that was the first book I did for Kensington, Murder in the Family. About Kirby Anthony, who raped and murdered his own aunt and her two little girls. And Mom Said Kill, which has been done about 3-4 times on TV, on these shows that Investigation Discovery.
Yeah.
And that's the mother, Barbara Opal, promised her 14-year-old daughter a brand new dirt bike if she and her little friends would murder her employer. I'll tell you right now, the kid never got the dirt bike.
Oh, sounds like a perfectly good mother. What was wrong with that?
Yeah, mother of the year. yeah, he was working as caregiver for this lady with Alzheimer's And the son, who was dying of cancer, was devoting himself to his mother instead of himself, and they were taking care of the mother. But the guy had 40 grand in the bank, and Barbara Opal decides she wants that 40 grand, so she gets her 14-year-old daughter to get a bunch of kids together to murder the guy for the money, $40,000.
As long as she gave them something for it, I think it was good.
Well, yeah, she probably could get a dirt bike.
Yeah, well... Make them work for it. That's responsibility.
Yeah. Well, teach them a good work ethic. You know, you want that bike, you got to kill Jerry.
Yeah, you got to do some work.
They did kill Jerry.
Yeah, do it right.
And then Fatal Beauty about, you know, Rhonda Glover, who killed her boyfriend because he was having sex with George Bush in a cave. And, Body Count, true story of the Spokane serial killer, Robert Lee Gates. And Headshot. That's 2.5 psychopaths, 3 trials. That is really the most bizarre case. That really is over the top. I mean, Andrew Webb kills a guy, slashes his throat because he doesn't want to get in trouble. He got in more trouble for killing the guy. And then his buddy shoots the guy in the head for no reason. Bury him, and then he thinks, gee, if they ever find that body, they'll find the bullet in his head. They can trace it to my gun. So he goes up and tries to dig the bullet out of the guy's head. Can't find it, so he cuts the head off, puts it in a bucket of concrete, and throws the bucket in the Puyallup River. But when they find the bucket, and they put it together with the body, I mean the head out of the bucket, the guy didn't die from getting shot in the head. The bullet went through his cheek and out the other side. All it did was break his jaw and knock him out. Apparently he came to just as they were about to bury him, and being that already decided to bury him, they stabbed him 17 times. That's a real strange case. There were 3 trials, 1 mistrial, and appeal to the state Supreme Court on that one.
Wow.
But the prosecutor said, of the 3 guys who were charged, the first one through the door gets the deal. Which is there we go, of course. And the first one through the door was Andrew Webb, promised to testify against the other 2 guys, gets up on the stand and says, tells the truth. Says, I killed them all by myself. I only said that to get my deal of no death penalty and life sentence with parole. He's out now, as a matter of fact. The 2 remaining living guys got out of prison and went to their high school reunion.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Well, it's always a pleasure talking about horrific crimes.
Yeah.
Or even amusing ones such as the one by Phil Champagne.
Well, yeah, that's quite unique. But
The latest thing I put up on available is another Deadly Sins tie-in called Deadly Sins, Jealousy, Sex, and Homicide in Los Gatos, California. And that's a little mini true crime story. That's a case on Deadly Sins that was on recently.
Oh.
But one gorgeous woman and 2 guys both having sex with her. One gets jealous and decides to hire a hitman to kill the other guy. The hitman he hired was so stupid, they left MapQuest directions from their house to the crime scene and the crime scene. Yeah. You know, they could have just left autographed 8x10 glossies of themselves.
Yeah, world of crime. Getting smarter.
Yeah. I'm getting no brighter. Anyway, thanks so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, it's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.